Good afternoon, everyone. It looks like everybody is in. Please check your chat function. Fong, the Pi GA, has put a welcome message to you. And if you could please enter your first and last name for your username, that would be great, because then we'll be able to correctly address you. And so you do that just by hovering your cursor over your name there in the participant list. If you go down to the bottom and see participants of your bottom of your screen, click on that, find your name. And it might not be your name. It might be, so we've had some very interesting labels for people. That would be helpful, and then we can correctly identify you. By the way, I'm Lisa Lozano. I'm the one that I'm sure you've got the email from. And I am the director of the Program for Instructional Excellence. It is wonderful to see you all. I know this is a very important topic, and I'm really excited myself about learning more about honor lock and alternative assessments. We will have a lot more workshops for you coming up this fall. So if there's something in particular you'd like to learn about this fall, please don't hesitate to send me an email, because we want to help you and keep having these virtual workshops to help you with everything you need to be able to do to have a really successful semester, which is going to be very different for us, I know. So I don't want to take up more time. I'm glad you're here. I want to welcome these fabulous, wonderful people we have from the Office of Distance Learning that are here today to help us out. So Mary, feel free to take it away.
Okay, great. I'm going to share my screen. Kip and Amanda, you can nod if you can see my screen. Everybody's looking good? Okay. I'm Mary Eichen, and I'm from the Office of Distance Learning. I'm going to briefly describe our other facilitators that will be working with us today. Kip Butts is our resident Canvas quiz expert and technical trainer. He helps instructors via one-on-one consultations or via email to set up their quizzes in Canvas in order to meet their varying needs. He's also one of our Canvas technical support technicians who answers our support tickets. Kip usually gets some of the most difficult ones. He also works for our systems team to help with our technical infrastructure here at ODL. And he creates our internal training on things like setting up your VPN, using Teams, updating your browser, things like that. He is indeed indispensable and irreplaceable. We'll also hear from Amanda Whitaker, who comes to ODL via a background in library science. So she is a librarian who is also very gifted with understanding and explaining technology. She's worked in our testing center as a live proctor, but has now been promoted to supervising our Tiger team, which is a set of testing center assistants trained by Amanda to help with technical support tickets during times of crisis, such as the pandemic, when all classes suddenly went remote. She helps test our new technologies and reports on ease of use, issues that may occur, and items for improved performance. She is also indispensable and irreplaceable. And then there's me, Mary Eichen. I am faculty admin here at FSU in the Office of Distance Learning. I have been here 7 years. I am the Assistant Director for Technology, which includes being the lead administrator for the Canvas LMS. And I am also currently the Interim Director for the FSU Testing Center. My graduate degree is Instructional Systems Design, and I have 23 years of experience as an instructional designer, which includes media production, project management, subject matter research, script writing, and training. Most of that at a consulting firm that developed online professional development and training, primarily for physicians, firefighters, foresters, and educators. So enough about us. Let's get started. So our objectives for today are listed on the screen. They're not in any particular order. Our audience today includes a wide variety of people, those with a lot of teaching experience to those with very little or none. And so there's some that are just starting their career, and then there's seasoned instructors. Teaching college freshmen and graduate students is different. So not everything here may be relevant, but we do hope there's something for everything. We may cover material you already know or if you've heard before, but there will be some things you haven't seen before. So because this is a very large group and we have a lot to cover, we'll have to use most of our time presenting, but we'll be taking questions in chat. And if we have time at the end, we're glad to take some live questions then. We also have a Canvas course site that we can put you in. If you registered for this webinar, we'll be able to add you to the site. And there will be additional resources on this topic. If you don't want to accept that invitation when you see it in Canvas, it's okay. If you decline, that's fine too. For a later part of this webinar, I'm just going to ask you to think about or look at maybe some course objectives that you have, if you have them, if you are teaching a course this term, and if you have those handy. If not, that's okay, but it just might be helpful for you to look at that at that point in the webinar so you can just sort of go along with what we're talking about there. So first up is Kip, and he is going to go over using the Canvas Quizzes tool to increase security and minimize cheating. And I'm going to unshare my screen.
Hello. I'm going to start with going through some content that we put together in the dev site that you may be getting an invitation for. And this is just some footnotes that I'm using here. When it comes to using tests in Canvas, we first want to look at more of a big picture approach. And that is that Canvas uses internal testing. And a lot of this testing, when built in such a manner, can be automated to automatically apply grades into the gradebook. This means that you can spend some time in the beginning to make a test, and then once it's been put together, for the rest of the semester and even following semesters, students will be able to take the test and get the grades in the gradebook automatically with little input afterwards. But we want to consider what type of things we're going to be testing. There are low stakes and there are high stakes for tests, quizzes, exams, and even just normal assignments. A rule of thumb is that if something is worth 20% or more of the final grade, it would be considered high stakes. And if we notice in Canvas, along the left-hand side here, quizzes is what Canvas calls their internal testing. They do this because by default, this testing apparatus is made for low stakes testing. And with low stakes testing, it's more used as a learning tool that can encourage students to do research and discover these answers, and even occasionally work with other students to help figure out what they're supposed to know and to come to the answers that you are hoping that they'll be able to come to. High stakes testing, however, is something where it's less of a learning tool and more of something that you're going to judge or gauge what their current level of knowledge is to see how they're doing with the course and with the material. And when there is a high stakes environment, that's when security does become more of a concern. And for these more high stakes testing, we generally have two main options: face-to-face, which currently isn't an option for us, or online. And for the face-to-face options, those have been like the FSU Testing Center, where we have proctors who would walk around watching testers, as well as numerous cameras making sure people aren't cheating. Or we have classrooms where like an instructor or TAs would be able to monitor and moderate the exams. But right now, we're using an online system. And FSU is going through HonorLock for the online proctoring. This means that students will use their webcam as well as a screen capture, similar to what you're seeing right now through this footage or through this video. The other option is not to have online proctoring at all, but that means that there's not going to be any reviewable security, so you can't confirm if students have been cheating. And if you wanted to use that method, it would require changing your strategy for testing. There are two main concerns with testing for security, and the two main ones are short-term and long-term. The short-term is pretty simple. Someone Googles a question to try to find an answer, or they have some notes tucked away that they pull out and read as they're testing that might have what they think the answers should be. Or they might call up a friend or do a text message to someone to see if they have the answers. These types of short-term cheating generally only impacts the handful of students who are actively doing it. And once you figure that out, you can address it, and it generally resolves the issue. Long-term impacts are considerably more long-term. This would be such as a student who takes a screenshot of a test, or they open up a Word document and they copy and paste all of the content. An example of that would be, if I were to copy this content and come into a Notepad, I can copy this test. And we want to make sure that this doesn't happen. Or a student can simply press the print screen button on a keyboard, go to MS Paint even, and they can have a picture of the entire exam that they can save and distribute. And there are a couple of reasons students would do this. Sometimes they want to share it with their friends. Other times they want to put it up on the market and try to sell it to people. So we definitely want to make sure that we catch this kind of behavior, because if we don't catch it while it's happening, it can be very hard to discover that it has happened and can remain a problem for multiple terms back to back. And that's something where HonorLock can help us prevent some of these items, and Amanda will be able to go over that. But I'm going to be going over the settings within an exam or a quiz itself. So I've put together a practice or an example quiz here, and I'm going to go in and edit this to show some of the options and features within Canvas. We have two main tabs up at the top, details and questions. Details are the settings that are going to apply to the entire test, such as the name, extra rules that you might want to have in here. And if you were to use HonorLock, this text field would also be full of HonorLock instructions. Under options, we do recommend shuffling, but it's not required. This will mean that if you have a question where option C is correct, another student taking the test may see it as option A is correct, and it will randomize for each student. And it will do this for every question in the test. We also recommend putting in a time limit. It should be careful about having too little time, so consider 30 seconds to a minute to answer each question. But if it's too long, then that will give students more of a chance to try to cheat through the test. If they have 6 hours to take a 5-question test, they might say, go to the bathroom to look up each question. The two check boxes here for multiple attempts and let students see quiz responses. These are fine for low stakes testing, but for high stakes, we strongly recommend disabling this. Both of them will allow students to see the test repeatedly with attempts, and with letting them see the quiz responses, it will even let them see all of the questions and answers after they finish the test. And once they finished it, we're unable to continue proctoring them. So it's very easy for them to copy and redistribute your exam material. It's also a good idea to enable show one question at a time if you're going to be using HonorLock's calculator or if you have lots of images in your test. But in general, this one is an option that you can go with or without. But we do recommend not locking the questions after answering, because this has caused some confusion with students and frustration because if this is enabled, they will not be able to go backwards. And most people do not have the selected, so they'll be shocked that they can't. And some students like to say, skip a question that they don't know and come back to it later. Under quiz restrictions, we have access codes and IP filters. If you do use Honor Lock will create a password automatically. Otherwise, you can put in your own password to share as needed. If you're going to be doing online testing for, say, a low-stakes quiz, using a password is a good way to do a pseudo attendance check. So partway through your Zoom session with your students, you can say, I have a quiz up for the day. It's only going to be open up for 10 minutes, and the password is going to be zebra. So then they'll only have a limited time to get in, and if they weren't in the class, they won't know the password to take it. The filter by IP more locks specific areas or zones. Right now, this is not a good option because everyone's scattered all over the place. But if we were to say, do your exam at the testing center, we've already set up IP ranges to include the testing center, the Office of Assistant Services, as well as the Panama City campus. But in that, if you were to say, want to proctor an exam inside of your office, your IP would also have to be added in here to work. And then finally for settings is the assign area. We want to make sure that in this assign area, we have a due date so that this will show up on the course syllabus to notify students when it's due. And we definitely want an available from and until. These two times will lock students out from being able to start until this time. And at this time, their exam will end. But we do want to be careful about how large this window is. Right now I have this set to be from 3 p.m. today till 4 p.m. That gives them 1 hour, but that's 1 hour to start their exam. If we come up and look at the time limit that I've set, they have 60 minutes. So most students would think, oh, I can start this test at 3:15, 3:30, and I'll have an hour. But right now I have it set to end at 4. So even if they start their exam at 3:30 and they think they have 60 minutes, they'll only have 30 because it will cut them off at 4. Because of this, we recommend extending this window a little bit and communicating with the students that there is a hard cutoff at the time you put SD until. In general, I like to say if you try to match this with your course to give them 15 to 30 minute window in case a student has technical issues or other difficulties that they didn't foresee getting into the test to start with. Next, I'm going to come up here to the questions area. And for these questions, I have created some non-question text boxes just to illustrate what I'm going to be talking about underneath there. These have no point values associated with them. So I'm going to start with multiple choice. This is one of the most common question types. If we come to edit this, we'll notice that I have a drop down here and I have selected multiple choice and I have a point value set to 1. I currently have 4 options here. 1 is the correct option and 3 are wrong options. If I wanted option, say C, to be the correct one, I can click on the green arrow to then turn this into correct, and now this one would be the wrong one. Additionally, if I wanted to have more options than this, I can come down to the bottom where it says add another answer, and I can create additional distractors. So initially I had 4 total options. Now I have 5. At the same time, if I want fewer of these options, to the right of any of these, we see a trash can. So I'm going to click on the trash can, and I'm down to 4 total options again. Since I've made changes to this question, I have to click Update Question for this to save and apply. Next option is we have multiple answers. This is very similar to multiple choice, and it's a little further down the list. But unlike multiple choice, this one you can have more than one option as the correct answer. Because of this, there is a chance that students may answer some correct and some incorrect. So there is partial credit for these types of questions. But this way you can have a 4 option question with 4 different choices and they can all be correct. And you won't have to make one at the end called all of the above. Since I have 3 options here and it can do partial credit, I have increased this to be worth a total of 3 points. Next, we have the very common true-false question. It's one of the second most common, so it is the second one on the list. And you simply put in your statement and you can check true or false. I've also applied this to be 1 point. Next, we have multiple dropdowns or dropdowns, which will allow you to follow the rules here. And you can create multiple questions in a single, questions in a single question area. So this is the first question, and this is the second one, where I have first inside of the brackets, it shows up here. And I have 4 options, 1 is correct. And then for second, I have 4 options, and that one is correct. Since there are 2 questions here, I set the point total to be 2. We also have matching, which in matching, you have a statement or a comment on one side that will match to it on the right. For this example, I just did 1-to-1, 2-to-2, and let me add 1 at the bottom for 5-to-5. These will get shuffled and randomized for the students when they're testing. I have also followed the rules in this box and added 6, 7, and 8. Since I just made a change there, I'm going to save this question. And I also set it to be worth 4 points since I had 4 options, but I now have 5. So I want to update this so that it has 5 points because I have 5 questions here that they're matching. You don't have to follow that point system, but that's the one that I'm following for this example. And next are some questions that may require review from the instructor or the TA or whoever would be administering this test. The first one is a numerical question. This one is mostly automated, but for this example, 40 plus 2 equals 42. So they would put in a numerical value, which I said has to be the number 42. Students are unable to enter other values in here. It's allowing E because that is a mathematical character. But other characters on my keyboard, it does not allow. So you can set an exact number here, as well as with the margin of error. And I do not want to save the changes I have made to that. The next is a fill in the blank, often referred to as a short answer question. In this, I'm saying that the correct answer is the word cow. And this will give students a text field to type in the answer. But because students can be very creative with how they answer something, I have to apply the correct characters that I think they will use. Someone may be very literal, or they might just put the word. They might retype a sentence saying that the correct answer is cow. They might say a cow, they might say the cow. And there are numerous other options that they can choose to show that they know what the right answer is. But if it doesn't exactly match what I have in here, Canvas will tell them that they did it wrong. And because of that, it is recommended to do manual review for these types of questions, because they may know the information and share it with you, but Canvas might not recognize that as an option listed here that would be correct. And the final type of answer or question that would require review is an essay question. With essay questions, they will have a text field very similar to what we're seeing right here to type in a question. They will get this box to type out a full answer. I've seen examples of this where students have typed out pages inside of an essay question for a high stakes test, one in which a student would have 90 minutes to 2 hours to simply answer 2 essay questions. And these will require manual review because there's no way for Canvas to recognize what is right and wrong in an essay. The next thing I want to go over are question groups in Canvas. We can take multiple questions and put them all together in a group, and Canvas will be able to shuffle those questions, pick select few options from those questions, and even use question banks that you may have saved and you can reuse from course to course or even throughout your current semester. I'm going to start with shuffled. I have the settings here to pick 4 questions in this group and to give them all 1 point each. This means that no matter what point value I want these questions to be worth individually, Canvas will say it's worth 1 point. So it's a good idea not to mix a true-false worth 1 point with, say, an essay question that could be worth 50 points. If my group says 1 point, that essay is going to be weighted exactly the same as the true-false. And in this example, these 4 questions will all be picked because I said to pick 4 of them, but it will shuffle them so the order will be randomized. So no two students will get the same order of questions theoretically. Next, I want to pick one of the questions from this group. So it's very similar. I have 4 questions in here, but I'm telling it to pick one of those questions and give it 1 point. And then finally, I have created a question bank in this exam, or in this course rather, and I've told it to pick 2 of those questions and make them each worth 1 point. I clicked here on PyBank because that is the name of my question bank, and it has 4 individual questions in it. So Canvas will apply 1 point to them and should pick only 2 of those 4 questions. We can then edit the questions in the bank in your question banks area in the course. So I'm going to cancel this. I'm now going to save it because I did make changes. And I'm going to preview this test, just so you can see roughly what students will be seeing. We see a list of all of the tests, or all of the questions, and the spacers here are not numbered questions, but this is just letting me know what type of questions I was asking. For all of my questions, I put the top answer as correct when I have this as shuffled. So this means C was correct now for this one. I had 1, 2, and 3, and they have been shuffled. True and false does not shuffle. In my dropdowns, it has randomized their order. Same thing with matching. I went 1 through 5 as my options that are correct, but I also added additional distractors for 6, 7, and 8. It did not shuffle the left options that I put, but it did shuffle the dropdown. So 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5. 42. It is a cow. Stuff. And now these have randomized. I numbered all of these questions 1 through 4, so it gave me 1, 4, 2, and 3. This is the one where I told it to pick 1 question, and it picked question 4 for me. And then this is the bank where I told it to pick two questions and it picked one and four. So I'm going to submit my answers. Since this is a preview, it will show me my feedback. If I was a student, it would not show this feedback, which is why we recommend not to give them that feedback in the settings. Otherwise, students would be able to look through here, see every single question with all of the answer options. And if we notice, I answered this question incorrectly because there wasn't an option, it is a cow. There was only a cow, and the cow would have been marked as correct. But I did put the correct information, so this would require manual review.
Kip, yes. Do you have a second for a relevant question to that?
Yes.
I did have somebody ask in chat if wildcards are supported. I don't believe they are, but I think you are a better expert on that topic than I am.
What do they mean by wildcard?
So if when you were putting in the answers that are acceptable for the fill in the blank, if you could put cow in like an asterisk, and then anything that came after cow would be accepted. So if they put cow, period, 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 or if you did an asterisk and then cow, so anything that said it is a cow.
Similar to how in, say, if you're looking up stuff in a computer, you could do this, where it ignores anything before and after and only cares about the word cow. To my knowledge, Canvas does not support this. So it would have to be the exact same matching. With the exception, Canvas is not case sensitive. So if they wrote cow in all caps, it would be the same as if they put cow in lowercase. However, let me get this turned on. And let's do... that. This would be marked as incorrect because this character with an accent is different from a normal C. Same if we were to have... that would also be considered incorrect because that is a separate character from a normal O. We can manually enter these if this was, say, a foreign language course and we wanted to judge their ability to enter the correct accents, we can check for that with the fill in the blank. Were there any other questions?
I think we're caught up on all of them so far.
All right, and I think I am done going over setting up quizzes. So that would go back to Mary, I believe.
Okay, hello again. These are the objectives that I'm going to be working on. So we're going to start with Bloom's taxonomy from the 1950s, but it's been discussed ever since, which is the range of lower order to higher order thinking skills. So remembering and understanding, they're on the lower end of the scale, with applying and analyzing being slightly higher, and then evaluating and creating being the highest types of thinking skills. So I got this information from the Faculty Senate site, which has a curriculum guide, and I put that link there, and that link will also be in the resources on the site that we invite you to in Canvas. There's a lot of verbs that correlate to the Bloom's taxonomy. Those verbs are what you would use, action verbs, to create your objectives. So you may want them to list something, you may want them to contrast, you might want them to experiment or examine or choose. And all of those verbs also sometimes, although they sometimes cross, they cross columns here, but they do line up to Bloom's taxonomy. And of course, if you have an objective that says, let's say it just says, list the types of questions in Canvas quizzes, then you would want to have an assessment that says list the type of questions in Canvas, right? So those would be a lower order thinking skill, but then for a higher one, you might have them create a quiz in Canvas with using different questions and evaluate how well those match their objectives and assessments. So of course I'm using a personal example on that, but we'll get more on that in just a minute. So this is a reflection activity. I mentioned this before, that you could use objectives that you have already for a syllabus that you're teaching with in the fall, or maybe a course you'd like to teach. But a really good exercise for thinking about low stakes versus high stakes is to think about your subject area. You know, either, like I said, either a class you're teaching or you want to teach. And then think about if you met a student 5 years down the road on a street, what would you want them to remember about that course? And what knowledge or skills or attitudes would you have liked to have them taken? This exercise is something that we normally do in a smaller workshop with others who teach similar content. So this group here is very varied with experience and content, and also our time is short. But if I were able to give you homework, I would ask you to think about this in terms of low stakes versus high stakes. For the next part, it may be helpful to have your objectives because I'm going to ask you a question or two, but that's okay if you don't. You can go back to this later and then, take a look and see what you have. So those of you who have objectives, I assume that they start with some action verbs. And are they mostly lower order thinking skills, higher order thinking skills, or is there a mix? So feel free to write that in the chat if you'd like. Now, many of the lower order thinking skills objectives are necessary to lead to the higher order thinking skills that we need for students to have. But usually what we want students to do 5 years from now is take the content and apply it or analyze it or evaluate or create or just have those skills because memorizing and regurgitation are not usually common skills that we use in the real workforce. So multiple choice tests, the ones that Kip showed you, aside from the essay one, they generally test the lower order thinking skills, remembering and understanding. But high stake tests should generally be the higher order thinking skills. So I don't know if you recall, Kip, did you go over this, why Canvas calls their quizzing tools quizzes and not exams? Yeah, you did.
Yes.
So I don't know if you recall that, but there is a reason for that. Their Canvas tools are called, Canvas is not called exams, it's called quizzes. It's because it's hard to use the quizzing tool for an exam where you're trying to get them to apply, analyze, or evaluate, or create. I'm not saying that all multiple choice questions only do remembering and understanding, because there are some that you can use the higher order thinking skills for multiple choice, but they're harder to create. Canvas also doesn't supply a proctoring tool. So if you are to do a multiple choice high stakes test, quiz, exam, whatever you want to call it, in Canvas, the instructors are expected to proctor multiple choice exams in the classroom, right? Or they could use something like HonorLock or a testing center. That doesn't mean Canvas quizzes aren't a great tool. They really are a great tool to help students practice with the lower order thinking skills, to review, to rehearse, to practice. So other terms that you might use for your Canvas quizzes for the lower stakes testing, for them to do some knowledge checks, reflections on the lecture, and review of the readings. So generally, I like to think of the Canvas quizzes tool as being used for that. That's not always the case, and I know that some people use the Canvas quizzes tool for high stakes exams, and we're going to talk about how that needs to happen so that we don't, and especially in this remote environment, so that we don't have blatant cheating and you know, the exam being delivered to people you don't want them to be delivered to. So where am I going with this? Well, if you want to use Canvas quizzes for high stakes testing, and you have three choices here. If you can't proctor face-to-face because you're teaching remotely, then we suggest you use HonorLock. And HonorLock comes with some issues, so you have to weigh that. If you don't want to use HonorLock, we say consider some alternative assessments or alternate assessments. And that takes some time to create alternative assessments. So if you aren't able to do that, or you don't have the kind of enrollment numbers where that would be feasible for you to grade, and you don't want to use HonorLock, then consider open book, open note exams. Because open book and tests, you know, with complex questions, it means that students really have to know the material. They have to know where to look if they need to check on something. They have to be very, very familiar with that content. So a well-designed open book multiple choice exam still requires the students to study and know that material. And as it states here, those who don't won't do well. And also teaching students to find information accurately and quickly helps them in the real world. We're just not going to remember everything. We have to look things up in our own jobs, and that's a learned skill. Babies do not know how to do that. So it's really a good skill for them to learn. and then in addition to open book exams for high stakes testing, you can make use of low stakes assignments like discussion board posts, which are very easy to grade compared to essays, short answer assignments, reflective journals, and practice quizzes. This part here on alternative assessments, I'd really love to have a workshop, you know, just on this part. They're not simple to develop, nor are quality, you know, multiple choice tests for that matter, but they don't, these ideas won't work in all content areas, but I do want to give you some ideas if you decide to choose the alternative assessment route rather than the high stakes multiple choice test using Canvas quizzes and HonorLock. And not an open book. So some of these could replace the final. Some could be just shorter assignments along the way that add up to a high stakes percentage. The first one I have is, you know, one of the more obvious ones, the Socratic seminar. That's something that could be done in discussion during class time, perhaps, you know, breaking out into small groups. It would take some practice to do this remotely, but it can be very effective way of students really processing and showing what they know in classes that aren't too large. Multimedia assignments that creatively demonstrate the understanding of a given course topic. That could be like a web page, a video, a song, performance, interpretive story. And when I say given topic, it may help if you're teaching the lower level courses to give them a list to choose from so they aren't like completely off target for a high stakes assignment. Or, you know, you can gauge if you think they're able to choose their own without having a list. Historical trial, people think of this as a mock trial, you know, from being a redo of something in history. But this could actually pertain to any subject area if you think about it. You just have to have opposing sides on a topic and then assign roles. And again, remotely, this may be, take some practice, but it really could energize the class on Zoom, and it lets students take the lead. The next one, a memorandum, brief, or executive summary. I would call this a real world skill. Students should have practice with this in every class because it takes a long time to get good at it. A group professional presentation. You know, have them present an idea or a concept, or, you know, as it's for a professional group, maybe at a conference or even a sales pitch. They get practice at this real life skill. And the great thing about presentations is that grading with a rubric can be done on the spot while they're presenting. So you can knock out a lot of the grading right then and there. Peer critiques and self-critiques are also really good exercises for these kind of presentations for the students to learn from these experiences and grow for the next time they present. Another one is an op-ed to a news outlet. I think this is a really great exercise for students to learn how to use facts to back up opinions from the course readings or from other readings on the course subject. That's also a really great life skill, and it's a learned skill, and it's something we should have our students practicing. An annotated anthology of course readings, that's a great way for students to go back to the readings and summarize and reflect and perhaps even evaluate the content. It can show how they grew, you know, in knowledge and understanding throughout the course. A poster session. You know, students pick a research topic from a given list, develop a creative title, you research their topic and present it to the class, and you could do this in groups as well. They should include a bibliography for a lot of these, by the way. They could have peers critique the presentation using a rubric, and instructors can also grade this right on the spot based on your own rubric. We see this at conferences sometimes, poster sessions with ideas or with things that are going on, and it's a really great life skill. And then there's some refinements to this. Like, I know that it's been used in a lab session. I lost my headset there for a second. Like when they can't really do a lab, but maybe they can be given a list of ideas, choose a topic, write a hypothesis, research that topic, and then create a conclusion to that hypothesis. The assignment can also include specific questions that students need to answer during the presentation, like, what did I expect to learn about this topic? How does this topic relate to me? What did I learn that surprised me? What did I find most interesting? Questions like that. What would I learn, you know, like to learn more about? A fact sheet on a given topic in the style is something that was, you know, be distributed in a public setting. And what I'm thinking here, I don't know why, is like how to prevent COVID-19 spread. I've seen some fact sheets on that. And this is a real life skill that can be applicable to so many content areas. And again, it's a learned skill that then this gives them practice on that. An annotated portfolio of work done throughout the term, identifying the work they're most proud of, and then you can give them a chance to revise the work they're least proud of. This definitely works in the arts and other places where students are creating and performing along the way. But it's also applicable to courses with quite a few short assignments, like perhaps one that has a writing element to it, writing credit to it, or public speaking, for instance. They really serve as a capstone assignment for the course, so it can take the place of an essay. And then also a reflective paper, where they use the objectives of the course. They detail what they learned about it, each objective, and what they'd like to learn more. This really has the students going back to the objectives, analyzing what they should have taken away and if they really actually did. And they can cite places in the course readings or lectures that help them learn the objectives. So those are some ideas. And like I said, I had to go through this quite quickly because we still have Amanda to go through HonorLock, which is really important for you to know. But we're going to find examples of some of these and also place them in the course that you'll be invited to as well. Now, you may have noticed most of these take some hand grading, and grading is a problem when you have a lot of students. But if you are hand grading, it is critical to use rubrics because students will know what you're expecting, and it's so, so much easier to grade with a rubric than without, I promise. If you don't know about rubrics and you haven't created them yet, ODL does have some support materials on that, and I've provided these links here, and this will be also in the course. The Center for the Advancement of Teaching, which Leslie Richardson is the director there, also has individual signups where you can bring your syllabus, and they can help you with creating your objectives and assessments and rubrics. So those are really helpful places to go. next up is Amanda's part on Honor Lock, and we mentioned that there's some issues with that. And one of the main issues is that students were really opposed to Honor Lock's, you know, privacy and security. They were worried about that. And some of the information came from a student post on Reddit where he was looking at the wrong Honor Lock privacy and security terms, not the ones that are contracted with FSU. And we have our own personal instance of Honor Lock where everything is kept completely FERPA compliant. But students still have issues sometimes with having to use their webcam, having to show their room where they're working, and having the recording of themselves taking a test. So that said, I am going to stop sharing and have Amanda take over from here.
Hello, everyone. I will be going over some information about Honor Lock, and we'll go ahead and share my screen. Give me just one moment. I do some trainings for Zoom, so I have some special settings set up where I have to move this to a different monitor so it's not in your way. So I am a librarian, a former librarian since I'm not currently in a library, and I am very enamored of Douglas Adams' Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. You might have noticed with the references to 42 in the practice quiz and that nice don't panic icon that we have in this development site that we've created. So first I do want to address sort of the elephant in the room when it comes to Honor Lock. I want to start out by acknowledging that all proctoring software has some vulnerabilities and that Honor Lock is no different. The security settings that Honor Lock provides will definitely stop some students from being dishonest. And it's a great tool that offers the ability to go back and review footage from the duration of the student's exams. Even still, we do recommend alternative assessments since no proctoring software is perfect, especially in a student's own home where they know all the nooks and crannies that they can try to hide things from a square framed webcam. Mary did mention that there had been some student privacy concerns. From what I have witnessed, it seemed to be a larger concern right up front, and then once students received the information that we had our own FERPA compliant instance, I haven't heard much about privacy concerns. There are some students who do not like the idea of anybody being able to see into their house through a webcam. But we are in extenuating circumstances where this may not be ideal, but we do still have to make sure that they are learning what they are supposed to be learning and not just going through the motions. So on our development site, I do have a list of Honor Lock resources that I have come up with throughout the time that we've been using it. And then this top one I feel is most relevant. It is the official Florida State University news press release that was sent to any students who were subscribed to the news. And then I believe Mary's link, which should be on here, has more in a frequently asked questions format that becomes a little bit easier for students to understand. With that, one of the ways that we can be a little bit more sensitive to students is to maybe provide clearer instructions about what we want to see through the webcam. This does come with the caveat that students might also be able to ferret out what areas they can get away with hiding also. Mostly, as somebody who actually reviews the footage, when I am compiling a report to figure out whether a student is being suspicious or not, I want to see the student's entire desk. I want to see everything within arm's reach of every angle of the desk. So everything between the desk and me, between the other side of my desk and the wall or whatever's on the other side, and to each side. It's especially helpful to see the floor and possibly just underneath the desk, because that's easy to reach down and grab a notebook or a spare 3x5 note card with formulas on it. We also want to see the wall that the student is facing, because they're staring at their screen, their webcam, and if they're flicking their eyes just beyond the webcam, it will become a little bit harder to watch those eye movements and figure out that a student is not looking at the test material itself. Other than that, we do want students to still do the 360-degree room scan so that we can make sure that there are no other people in the room, there aren't instructions or formulas or other unapproved materials written on a different wall that they're looking at. But those are slightly lower concerns, since it's much more obvious if I'm turning to my right to look at the wall to my right. So that might be a way that any students who are concerned about letting instructors or proctors see into their home can be have their fears relieved. So to get started on the actual honor lock meat and bones, honor lock first and foremost requires the Chrome web browser, which is this lovely, nice, colorful one right here next to my Firefox. And anybody can install Google Chrome. It is completely free. It has a significant market share right now, so many students already use Chrome. So doesn't come up as a problem very often. Students will have to install the Honor Lock extension. And then anytime you have your exam set up, it will actually prompt students to install it if it is not installed. The exam and the Honor Lock setup will actually check the browser that is being used to access the quiz and see if it is Chrome and if the Honor Lock app is installed. That's the extent of what it does until a student allows it to access the webcam and the screen. And you'll see that I already have this extension added. And these can be simple searches. They can also be links added to the quiz instructions area, which would be this area right here, which is also this box right here. To get Honor Lock up and going, you'll need to go to your course site, any page, and then come out down here to the settings for the course. This does need to be done individually by course. In the settings, you'll want to come to this middle tab and click on navigation. And then these are all the things that are enabled for my course, for our dev site. And we'll need to come down here, drag items here to hide them from students. These are things that are disabled. This page is disabled. It won't appear in the navigation. So you can either click and drag it up into this top part, which are things that are enabled, or you can just click on these three dots and click on enable. You'll see it is now down here at the bottom. If you'd like, you can move it to wherever you want in the list. I'll go ahead and put it under quizzes just for this to make it easier for me to remember where it is. With the navigation and settings, you always have to come down here and click save. During our practice runs, I would disable honor lock so that I can make sure that I show you these steps. And I would constantly forget to click save and be confused as to why it was already enabled. So just even somebody who works with this and trains on this constantly, I still forget to click save. So that is an important step. Once we have honor lock enabled for the course, we can click on it. And it will show you any quizzes that you currently have started. So if I just wanted to make a completely blank quiz, already called unnamed quiz, don't even have to publish it. When I come here to honor lock, it will be listed. Any quizzes that you initially start can be enabled at any time. So if I knew that I wanted to have three exams for my course, I could go ahead and enable it now to make sure that students couldn't, or to make sure that I didn't forget that honor lock was already in there or was needing to be enabled. When we click on enable, we'll get a set of options. You have some fairly obvious ones, record webcam, that will use the student's webcam and record their face and some of their surroundings. They will use that webcam to show their desk and the walls around them in the 360 degree view, which is also its own setting, the room scan. There's the record screen, which, as Kip said, is recording my entire monitor right here from corner to corner. Record audio is automatically on. That will help anybody reviewing footage pick up on things that should not be going on in the background, like flipping pages. All of these can be turned off, but just keep in mind that it does open up some security risks. Record web traffic is on. We have had students, mostly at the beginning when we first contracted with Honor Lock, who were afraid that Honor Lock was crawling throughout their web traffic on their routers or internet in general, and seeing what other people in the house might be looking up, what they might be looking up on their phone. It only records the web traffic for the session that they're on right now during the test. It does not check and see what other people on the network are looking up. If my husband decides to look up YouTube videos while I'm taking a test, that will be irrelevant. It does not track that. It's not relevant to us reviewing it as proctors. The student photo and the student ID both work hand in hand. The photo will take a picture of my face so that the proctors can see who is actually taking the test. And the student ID will prompt the student to hold their valid ID up to the camera so that we can get a look of the picture and compare it to the student photo that was just taken to make sure that I am taking this test instead of my sister taking this test or my husband taking this test for me. That is just an extra layer of security that makes sure that nobody is passing off the testing burden to somebody who they feel is more knowledgeable. I touched on the room scan already. You don't have to get detailed with your room scan. You could just simply say, do 360 degree scan. The network speed test is good because it will relay that information to the proctors. So if a student is constantly disconnecting and reconnecting, but their network speed test shows that they've always had an excellent connection, that might be more suspicious than a student who was constantly disconnecting and reconnecting, but had a bad internet connection. Some things are outside the student's realm of control, such as who their internet service provider is, or the fact that internet service providers have worse network speed if they live in a rural area. But it does give extra information so that we can ascertain whether a student is being honest or dishonest. The first setting that is off by default is the basic or scientific calculator. You can turn these on and it will show an on-screen calculator. So we'll always be able to see when they're using a calculator as opposed to looking down at a calculator like my phone. Disable copy and paste and disable printing are both on by default. And Kip went over that briefly. Students will not, when they're in the test, will not be able to click and drag and copy any text or images into something else. And students will not be able to print to an actual printer, print to PDF, or even click the print screen button. They can click the print screen button or tap it on their keyboard, but any resulting image will be just a blank black square. It will not have any information in it. Students can only use a single display, and that will make sure when they have multiple displays hooked up, like on my home setup for work, it will require students to actually disable the displays so nobody can use a second monitor to look up answers. Browser guard is off by default, and we always recommend turning it on. Turning it on will ensure that students cannot go to other tabs and, for example, Google a question. It will close any tabs that were already open when they actually start the test. And if a student clicks to open a new tab, it'll immediately close it until it's unauthorized. The other side to this, if you want them to access certain websites, like if I was having somebody write their opinions on Grimm's Fairy Tales, and I wanted them to have access to source material, I could whitelist certain URLs. So I have Grimm's Fairy Tales here, and I will go ahead and authorize my students to use this one particular file, Gutenberg.org, which offers free, copyright-free ebooks. And I will go ahead and add it to the exam whitelist. So now students will be able to go to this website. For this website, it is a little bit complicated, so I would definitely want to consider adding it to the student instructions here or on the quiz instructions so students have a better opportunity to click on it rather than remembering it to type in. The final one is a simulated exam. We recommend keeping that off. It makes a student go through all of the steps above, showing their ID, taking a picture of their face, clicking record screen, but it doesn't actually save any footage. It just simulates the fact that you're sitting in front of a computer and have an Honor Lock logo. It might keep students who are afraid of the possibility of proctoring honest, but it won't give anybody an opportunity to go back and review any footage that comes from it. So if somebody decided to be a little bit more bold and go ahead and look at something that they shouldn't have, we wouldn't be able to catch that. If you have a third-party integration or a test through a third party, you can set that up by coming up here to the top and these three buttons. And you would come down here to register third-party exam. You will get those same options as below. The difference is this one will not directly link to that third-party application. You have to copy that information over. So if my exam from Pearson was exam 2, I would have to tell Honor Lock when I set Pearson to start and when I set Pearson to end. I would have to tell Honor Lock what the password is so Honor Lock could securely insert that so students didn't see it. And then I would need to tell Honor Lock I did this through Pearson so that any live proctors who popped in would be able to have that information in order to help a student who was having trouble getting there. And you can set up a profile for that too. Let's go ahead and go back. This is the one that I have some footage set up for. So I'll go ahead and re-enable this. Again, I have my Gutenberg whitelist. And then the last couple ones that I wanted to point out when setting up HonorLock is the student instructions and proctor guidelines. The student instructions, this is where you would include anything you want the students to see before the test. They will only see this once when they are first getting ready to start the HonorLock session. So if you wanted students to pick up any phones they have and take it far away, this is where you'd want to do it. This is different from the Canvas instructions that students can constantly refer to throughout the test. The students will not see the proctor guidelines below here. And the live proctors and any session reviewers will not see these student instructions. So we do recommend copying anything that you've told students and putting it in the proctor guidelines also, so that we know what students have been told. Or so that anybody reviewing or who might do a live pop-in will know that. For the proctor guidelines, HonorLock live proctor who might pop in will be able to see these guidelines. You can add instructions to that proctor, such as please add back lost time for students who have technical difficulties. So if I spend 15 minutes trying to figure out how to get everything to work and I've lost that time off my Canvas quiz, proctors should be able to add that time back in as long as they have approval from you. I have reviewed an instance where a proctor had to contact an instructor had to contact the proctors during the exam for a student because this wasn't noted in there. It is not required. You do not have to make this accommodation, but it is something to consider. When reviewing after the exam, you or a proctor that you designate will have access to these proctor guidelines, just like a live proctor pop-in, which again, we recommend including the student instructions down here so that those can be referenced. So we'll go ahead and save this. I will take a moment to move away from this. And I have some example footage of what it looks like from the student's point of view that I've recorded myself.
Amanda, if I have a moment?
Of course.
One of the individuals is having a screen issue. Would it be okay if you stopped sharing and then reshared just to refresh? Thank you.
Yeah.
Also, I do want to mention we have about 13 more minutes, Amanda.
Okay.
So it doesn't allow third-party sharing?
No, it does. I don't know what third-party exam, what's the purpose of that?
That is for instructors who would use, for example, Pearson or WW Norton. There are a few third-party integrations that you can add from here, like if somebody was using McGraw-Hill Connect, usually they're publishers who have their own question banks already pre-made. It's not terribly common, but I did want to address it just in case anybody had that question so that it didn't get overlooked. Okay, and then can everybody see my screen again?
Yep.
Okay.
Yes.
Just double checking. Let me go ahead and pop this out so it's full screen. I think that helps its resolution a little bit. So I started from the beginning so you would be able to see exactly what students see. They click launch proctoring. It pops up a second window, gives them some instructions. Now it wants them to take that picture that I mentioned. And it will ask for a picture of my ID and gives you a box to frame it. After that, it will ask you to start a room scan, gives you a countdown, and gives you these instructions to reminding students to show the desk area and any scratch paper. If you allow scratch paper for your student, we do recommend asking them to hold it up to the screen to show that it was blank when they first started with it, so that they were not bringing in any outside unauthorized notes. It does have the I'm done button. After the student clicks I'm done, it will start instantly replaying what they just recorded. And then it gives them the option to redo their room scan or submit it. They can redo the room scan as many times as they want, which can be helpful for proctors because sometimes it didn't do it for mine, probably because it's test footage, but I have encountered exam footage where I was watching it and it continued recording the webcam while the student was reviewing this. So I have been able to see students grabbing a piece of paper or some notes when they thought that they weren't being watched. But once you click begin proctoring, you have given permission to HonorLock to start. After the room scan, it will ask you to launch the screen recording and ask you to close any tabs. You'll highlight the window and share it. And once you click begin, HonorLock is transmitting the access code to Canvas without showing it to the student. This is where you can see any of those instructions that you have. The HonorLock instructions only showed up once, but these instructions can be accessed at any point by clicking on those show instructions. And these are the ones that are specifically in the Canvas instruction box when you build the test. And then I did want to go over a little bit about reviewing footage to catch anybody being dishonest. That again is through the HonorLock menu option. After it has been enabled, you can go back and change the settings, which will look just like when you first enabled it, except it will have saved everything that I had already put in. The other option is the results. And from here, we can see the students' names. HonorLock does not care about who's taking what test, so they assigned a student ID so that it stays anonymous on their servers. We can see when the exam was started, at what time, and when it was ended. So we can see how long they took. And it also assigns a incident level. So I have a couple example footages where there was a high incident level and a couple where there was not. So if we were to click view session, pause this. When you come down, you can click on the specific incident level and it will give you a description of what happened and why it was flagged that way. So in this instance, I had specifically told my computer to stop sharing. And if a student specifically tells HonorLock to stop sharing my screen, as opposed to having a network outage, that would be something that would be that they consider a red flag that might want to be reviewed to see if it was legitimate or whether it was a mistake or whether it was something else. They have tags such as test window lost focus. This is where I tried to go to a different area. So if I were to open up, for example, Microsoft Paint, like Kip showed us earlier, it would say test window lost focus because I had left the Canvas exam. And then this is the room scan from our point of view where we're watching. It's basically what the student had reviewed. And this has now had a data process, so it might show. Nope, this one cut off probably because it hasn't had as much time to process or because of any other reasons that I just don't know off the top of my head. I'm sorry. But we have the ID picture. It gives that photo that you've taken next to the ID so you can verify that it's the correct person. There's the room scan to make sure that there are no unauthorized materials. HonorLock will not flag anything because it is using a system of AI, so it does not pick up on, is this person allowed to have X many pieces of paper? This is something that you would definitely want to review yourself. There are options to increase the playback speed. So if you need to fast forward, or if you're just checking in general to make sure that a student is on focus. As you can see here, I demonstrated looking down a lot. I tried demonstrating looking away from the computer. You can go back 10 seconds, forward 10 seconds, and click on any of these flags or any of these notifications.
Amanda, somebody asked a really good question. Mm-hmm. What are you finding from your honor lock reviewing is some of the most common flags that actually indicate cheating?
There have been some flags where the most common flags that I see are face not clearly visible. So if I can pull my Zoom meeting up so I can see my live webcam, that would be like if I came really close and like the bottom got cut off. I see this more with people using like laptops, but I have seen some students use it to try to cover them looking down at something. The other most common flag that I see is the test window lost focus, although I have noticed that uncommonly comes up when students are trying to access the honor lock calculator. I might have to assemble a list of that and include that in our development site just to better answer the question. It's one of those things where I'm so used to seeing it, but now that I'm asked to relay that information.
Marissa answered too, Amanda. She said that students are talking out loud and there's multiple people in the room as well as often flagged.
Yes. As you can see right here,
Amanda, I think you're muted.
Oh, I'm sorry about that. I was pointing out a couple of the false positives that we have gotten. These posters behind me, if there were more faces and less masked superheroes, then it can sometimes change, or sometimes Honor Lock can flag that as having an extra person in the room. But it usually is pretty good about making sure that it recognizes an actual face before it flags it. So it can miss when there are other people in the room who are just talking and not necessarily in view. So like Marissa said, a lot of the flags come from talking. Either the student will be talking and maybe verbally working through their exam content, or it could be that somebody off screen is talking to the student and trying to help with answers. And then just to go over a couple things real quick, some of the things that you can look for to figure out whether a student is being dishonest or not. We have the room scan and audio cues and visual cues to figure out whether students are using the proper materials. If you allow scratch paper, but don't allow a calculator and they're looking down and tapping on something. It could be their phone. It could be an unallowed calculator. It's always good to watch their eyes. So right now I'm looking directly at my webcam, but I can also see the wall behind me. So you wouldn't be able to necessarily tell if I had notes on that wall. But if I look down at the notebook that I leave on my desk for reminders, you can tell that my gaze is below where I have been looking as I've shown you things on my screen. So you want to watch for them looking at any illogical areas if you do allow scratch paper. When I review footage, I kind of keep track of where I last saw the scratch paper, where they're writing. And then if I see their eyes looking somewhere other than there, that's a good sign of dishonesty. And then also the length of time that they're looking. My husband just sat down at his work computer and just because we've done this so many times that since going remote with COVID, I didn't turn to look. But if a student didn't have much control over their environment and had to take their exam with their door open because their parents, you know, demanded that, somebody might walk past the door and they might instinctively look. So the length of time that somebody's looking away or the frequency of time that somebody's looking away can be a good indicator of dishonesty or just reaction. Some things that we have also seen are lighting changes. You'll see I have glasses on. I'm not sure if you can tell, but I have three monitors. You might be able to see three distinct squares reflecting off my glasses. You might be able to see my light source right in front of me and above reflecting off my glasses. And we have seen students use multiple devices that way. We have also seen instances where students have had, for example, a TV in the room, in the room scan, and see them after they've finished showing us that it's off, subtly reach over and turn it on, and then suddenly there's a new light source on them. Like I said, listening for shuffling papers, listening for phone or computer notification noises, other people talking. If other people are in the room or if we hear somebody come into the room, they could try passing notes to the students out of view of the camera or connect a computer up to a previously noticed but turned off TV and start displaying information that could be used for the student during the test. Those are the most common instances. It's definitely not going to be a comprehensive list, but the best thing to do when reviewing footage is to definitely look at the eyes and kind of watch where they're looking. Once you've done it enough, you can kind of tell when somebody's reading. They generally track at a steady pace and then flick back to the next line. Whereas if I saw somebody flicking to one side and then flicking back, that would be a completely different matter than them reading the question. And I think that's about all I had that I thought would be good to relay without being too overloading. So I can kick it back over to Mary. And I think if she doesn't have anything else, then I think we can go into a Q&A, though we're out of time.
I just also wanted to say that somebody had asked about what if students don't have the proper equipment for Honor Lock. You can give them an alternate assessment, obviously. And then there is an FSU website that can help students who don't have laptops or the right equipment get them. I can't think of it right now, but we'll put that in the resources page also. We are about out of time. I did want to show this screen, which is our Canvas technical support. We have a whole host of hundreds and hundreds of documents at the support site that goes over everything we have just talked about and much more. And then ODL is offering workshops on remote instruction this summer. So you can go to that link to see what we're offering and join more. If we have some questions, we could go ahead and take those now. Or goodbye.
Actually, I have a question. Sure. So I'm curious about the next step once footage is reviewed, because it seems like in a lot of these cases that we're mentioning where I review the footage and I say, you know, student, it looks like you were looking around quite a bit. You were looking to your left, you know, you're doing all these things that seem suspicious. And then the student sort of insists like, no, I was just looking around as I thought, like I wasn't cheating. You know, it's not on the footage, you can't prove it. Do we just sort of try and force it through? What is sort of the next step in these kind of ambiguous cases of looking around a lot or a light source changes, but that it doesn't seem definitively cheating?
I would say that's a really good question, and it's difficult to answer. students do cheat right in front of instructors in course in their class too, and then say, "Oh, I wasn't doing that." So and we see that in the testing center as well. I mean, I think the good news is there really is a low percentage of students who actually cheat, and so you know, unless you see something specific, and we have had cases where, you know, people come in the room and tell them the answers. We see that on video, and so that would be a blatant, and it goes through, you know, an honor board and such. And somebody asked how many cases we had, and I heard, and I don't know if this is true, but there was, you know, over 100 since we've been using them, but there's also been like 70,000 exams taken or something like that on Honor Lock. So there's been a lot of usage. It's still a very low percentage. If it's flagged yellow or flagged green, it doesn't mean they didn't cheat, because they can't catch everything. If it's flagged red, it doesn't mean they were cheating. You kind of have to just, you know, do your best to make that decision as an instructor.
Okay, thank you.
I've got a question for you, Mary. Someone was asking about the testing center. Uh-huh. Do we have any information on when or if it will be reopening?
We obviously cannot open the testing center to our full 100% capacity and still meet the CDC guidelines that are currently in place for a separation of 6 feet. Because I don't know if you've ever been in our testing center, but it's packed full of seats and computers. So our plan is to open, but only for exams that cannot be taken online. And that, for instance, is CLEP, which we currently haven't been offering, but we do want to offer again in the fall. And some other exams, such as TEAS, which are offered online. They are not offered online, and they have to take them with a proctor, a live proctor. And also students, and someone asked a question about, you know, the computer equipment, who perhaps don't have the computer equipment to take an Honor Lock exam. With instructor's permission, they can be asked, they can ask to use the testing center, or if they have, you know, another reason why they can't use Honor Lock and the instructor gives them permission to come, and they don't have an alternate assessment for them. I hope that answers your question.
And I see that there was a question about how Honor Lock interfaces with students with dispensations from the OAS, formerly SDRC. I have not had an opportunity to test this myself, but from what I understand, just based on ADA, the ADA law, they should be fully compliant with any and all special accommodations needed. If they are registered with OAS and have specific instructions that instructors need to accommodate, such as extra scratch paper or extra time, those instructions could be added to the proctor guidelines when setting up the exam. I have seen in my position reviewing the exams that certain people are listed and are allowed X materials, whereas everybody else is not. And then that information, when it's in that proctor guidelines area, is only visible to Honor Lock if a live proctor pops in to try to correct an issue, or for anybody who has authority to review that footage, which would be the testing center and any teacher or TA in the class, the course itself. And I think I answered that, but if I missed the mark, please go ahead and ask a follow-up question to that. That sounds good.
Were there any questions asked that we ended up missing in the chat?
I did want to mention that I noticed when I was doing my presentation, and I wasn't really monitoring the chat very well, but that the objectives do, obviously the lots and the hots, it matters upon subject. subject area, and somebody mentioned that. Depends on the subject. And also, yes, you do have a lot of lots that will lead to the hots. So we sometimes call those sub-objectives, and they should align with the more hot objectives. So that was the answer to that question. Well, thank you all for coming. And I don't know if, Lisa, you want to say anything before we leave?
Yeah, well, first of all, I just wanted to mention that we are coming up on our last session tomorrow for a two-week boot camp that we put on for online instruction or online course design, I apologize. And Katie Kelly, who is on this call, she covered last week putting together course objectives and the alignment. And so her materials are on our PI website, and we'll be giving you the link, and I think Fong put it in the chat, to her video and her PowerPoints. So you can also feel free to go look at that. Like you said, I know Kat also helps with that. And that's a wonderful resource too, of course. But if you quick want to look at a video and Katie's materials, that's up on our PI website as well. And also, of course, I want to thank you all. So Mary, Kip, Amanda, Marissa, our wonderful ODL folks, I don't know what we would do right now without you or ever without you. We appreciate you all so much. And thank you all for attending. I did put the link to the survey. We always do an evaluation survey, but we'll email that out to you as well. And we'll also email you the link to the place on the website, which Fung just stuck in the chat, so you can copy that. And we'll make sure, I don't know how we'll do this, I'll send you the information and you through ODL can send them the invite to the development site, the Canvas site, or however, we'll get it to you all anyway.
Yep, we'll do that.
And please, and all of you that are attending, just let us know, let me know, let Pi know what you want for further workshops, because of course we're gonna just keep doing these. We always do them, but now I can do even more because I unfortunately I'm not able to provide you with pie and coffee like I do face to face. So the good news about that is don't have to worry about controlling our numbers. So we can have hundreds of people and it's fine. So just in that evaluation survey, there's a place where you can enter topics that you'd like us to cover. So we'll accommodate whatever we can. So good luck. Thank you again for coming. It's wonderful to see you all. And yes, I know Jorge, I see you in the chat. You missed the pie and coffee. I do too, very much. I hope you're all staying safe. And thanks so much. I don't know if Mary and the ODL folks have time to stick around if you still have questions, but maybe they do if you do.
I do.
Thank you, Mary.
Sure. Maybe.